and this is the Convict Australia podcast. Thank you for tuning in. As the sun rose up over Sydney Harbour on the morning of the 29th of March, 1791, a rumour was spreading around the small colony like a wildfire. Convicts had escaped with a boat. The news whipped around them and they stopped what they were doing to speculate. Who was missing? How did they manage to steal the government's boat? And where will they go? It was soon discovered that Mary Bryant, her husband, and their two small children, along with six other convicts, had made their escape during the night. This is her story. Mary Broad was born in the bustling village of Foy in South Cornwall in 1765. Foy was a maze of narrow streets that led to the steep bank on the river estuary. Her father worked as a mariner on the twisting waterways that join the picturesque towns. Foy had once been an important trading centre, but since the trade had begun favouring Plymouth, the fortunes for the harbour were in decline. Life for the Broad family must have been a struggle. Mary was 5 feet, 4 inches tall, with long brown hair and captivating grey eyes. She was only 21 years old when she was arrested and charged, along with two other young women, of robbing a woman by the name of Agnes Lakeman of her silk bonnet and her goods, probably her jewellery. In the docks at the Assizes in Exeter, the three female offenders received the shocking news that they were to be hanged for their crimes. This sentence was later commuted to transportation beyond the seas for a period of 7 years. Mary was held in an Exeter prison until she was transferred to a prison hulk in Plymouth called the Dunkirk. Her time on the Dunkirk was horrid. The weather had been extreme and unmerciful, with constant storms and heavy rainfall, which made its way down to the dark depths of the ship where the convicts were held. Everything was damp and musty. The Dunkirk had a reputation of being a brutal place for women. The Marines were said to have abused their power with the women on board, that resulted in a code of orders being drawn up in a futile attempt to make life better for the women and offer them a morsel of protection. It was during her incarceration here that Mary discovered that she was with child. It would be a year from the date she was arrested to when she was finally moved to the transport ship, the Charlotte, that would carry her and roughly 88 male convicts, about 19 other female convicts, 45 Marines, and approximately 24 crew to New South Wales. This was just one of the 11 ships of the First Fleet that was set to make the biggest migration to date. Charlotte was 105 feet long and 28 feet wide, and was a two-decked, three-masted bark, and had a very comfortable height of 6 feet and 6 inches between decks. Amongst the convicts that were transferred from the Dunkirk to the Charlotte was William Bryant, who had been convicted at Launceston Assizes in 1784. Like Mary, he had been sentenced to death, but his sentence was later commuted to 7 years. William was in his late 20s and had spunk and a boldness that often got him into trouble. He had been arrested for impersonating two of Her Majesty's seamen and receiving part of their wages. Before his arrest, he had been working as a fisherman and mariner, just like Mary's father had been. The two of them quickly struck up a friendship. The Charlotte left Portsmouth, England, along with the 10 other ships of the First Fleet, in May 1787. William and the rest of the men were shackled with heavy leg irons. As the months passed, Mary's belly grew until she gave birth on the ship. Surgeon General John White noted in his journal, quote, "Mary Broad, a convict, was delivered of a fine girl," end quote. Mary named her daughter Charlotte after the ship. Once the First Fleet arrived and settled in the new colony, Mary and William were married just 4 days after landing. They were given a hut and William's fishing skills were put to good use. His contribution to the colony's food supply was invaluable, and he was able to negotiate the privilege of keeping part of his catch of fish for himself. Despite this indulgence, within a year of their arrival, William was caught selling part of the fish meant for the government stores and received 100 lashes. Mary, Charlotte, and William were all tossed out of their hut. He was allowed to keep working as a fisherman, as the colony desperately needed his skills, but a very close eye was kept on him. In April 1790, Mary and William welcomed the birth of their child Emmanuel into their family. By this time, the colony was on the brink of starvation. Captain Tench wrote in his journal, quote, "Famine was approaching with gigantic strides, and gloom and dejection overspread every countenance," end quote. The ration had been drastically reduced, and the food that they did receive was pitiful. Tench noted, quote, "The pork had been salted between 3 and 4 years, and every grain of rice was a moving body from the inhabitants lodged within it," end quote. Relief came with the arrival of the Second Fleet, but there was still doubt over whether the colony would be able to sustain itself. It was around this time that William and Mary hatched a plan to escape the colony and what they deemed as certain death. They could not watch their children starve to death. Over the coming months, Mary and William set about carefully collecting provisions. They knew they needed the help of others and entrusted their plan to a few select convict friends who were also eager to escape. When a Dutch trading vessel arrived in Sydney, William became friends with the captain and had soon acquired a map, compass, a quadrant, 2 muskets, and pork and rice, which he secreted under the floorboards of his hut. Despite their best efforts to keep their escape a secret, their plan was discovered. Collins wrote they were, quote, "overheard consulting in his hut after dark with 5 other convicts on the practicability of carrying off the boat in which he was employed. This circumstance being reported to the governor, it was determined that all his proceedings should be narrowly watched and any scheme of that nature counteracted," end quote. But the very next day, whilst William was carrying out his duties of catching fish for the colony, the cutter was struck by a sudden squall. William and his crew had no choice but to abandon the boat and swim to shore. Collins then felt confident that any plans William might have had in escaping by boat was gone. His watch over him slackened. But Collins didn't bank on William and Mary's determination, and they continued collecting provisions for their escape. During this time, they accrued a fishing net, cooking utensils, hooks, nails, tents, flour, bedding, tools, fishing lines, rosin, and a set of sails. By now, William's sentence had expired, but the authorities had no proof of this. In fact, the authorities had not been given any documentation on the expiry of any of the sentences. Therefore, they continued to be treated as convicts serving their time. Private John Eastey commented on their predicament, quote, "They are the same as slaves all the time they are in this country. Although there are times for which they are sentenced are expired by law, there is no difference between them and a convict that is just cast for transportation," end quote. Mary must have felt a deep frustration when she saw her husband, a free man, being treated as a slave. The look of hunger in the faces of her children and the deep lacerated scars across her husband's back. They must have felt that their situation would never change and they would be worked to their death. They bid their time until the perfect opportunity presented itself. The Supply was the only ship left in the colony after the Sirius had been wrecked at Norfolk Island in March 1790. A year later, the governor decided to send the Supply to Norfolk Island, and a visiting Dutch vessel called the Snow had left the colony that morning. If they made their escape now and got a good head start, there wouldn't be a vessel big enough to catch up with them. The time to go was now. They waited till nightfall to make their move. William and his crew were on fishing duty. There was no moon that night as one of the men slipped down to the government's cutter and untied it from the jetty. As quietly as they could, they hastily grabbed the provisions they had collected and piled them on board the cutter. Mary carried her sleepy baby and urged her daughter to quickly make her way through to the boat without making a sound. Her heart must have been pounding inside her chest, willing little Emmanuel not to cry out. With everyone on board, they pushed out and began sailing the cutter out of the harbour. Besides Mary, William, and their two children, aged just 1 and 3 years old, were William Allen, James Cox, and Nathaniel Lilly, who all held life sentences. There was also Samuel Bird, William Morton, James Martin, and John Butcher. Morton was a navigator, and at least Allen and Cox had experience with boats. At daybreak, they were discovered missing. David Collins noted, quote, "They were traced from Bryant's hut to the point, and in the path were found a handsaw, a scale, and 4 or 5 pounds of rice scattered about in different places, which, it was evident, they had dropped in their haste," end quote. On closer inspection of Mary and William's hut, authorities discovered a hidey hole under the floorboards. They also uncovered a well-hidden letter from James Cox to his girlfriend, Sarah Young, which outlined that he was leaving all his belongings to her. By now the escapees were well out of the harbour and in open waters. They had secured the head start that they so desperately needed to make their escape. Their plan was to make their way to Timor, create new identities, and get the next passing ship back to England as free people. Although the idea of making it to Timor in a cutter seemed impossible, similar feats had been accomplished. It was a huge risk, but one they felt worthy of taking, and so began the mammoth task of inching their way up the east coast of Australia. Along the way, they needed to regularly pull into beaches to collect fresh water and patch up the boat. These early stops were such moments of joy for them, as they felt truly free for the first time in their lives. They would bask in the sun during the day, catch fish and cure them. At night, they would light a fire and sit around it cooking their supper and imagining what their new lives would entail. They would entertain each other by inventing their new names and characters with interesting backstories. As wonderful as it was to dream, there must have been a niggling fear that Charlotte would give them away by mistake. She was only a toddler after all, and could easily slip up. This would have added to Mary's worries and placed a lot more pressure on her, as it would have been her role to keep her daughter close and keep her from giving their real identities away. Occasionally they would run into danger with the natives, but often they had very positive encounters with them. It taught them to always be on guard and ready to launch the boat back out to sea. They also faced dreadful storms that would leave them soaked to the bone. Because of the rain, they couldn't even light a fire to warm their weary bodies and were forced to eat raw rice. Beaching and launching the boat wasn't an easy feat either. One time, they were driven out to sea without being able to catch a glimpse of land for 3 weeks. But through all these difficulties, they did have some extraordinary moments of wonder, like watching turtles coming to the shore to lay their eggs. Although it is not known with any certainty which particular beaches they stopped at, it is thought that maybe Newcastle, Port Stephens, and Moreton Bay were among them. It is also thought that they may have stopped at Lady Elliot Island on the southern tip of the Great Barrier Reef, as they were reported to have feasted on turtle and a fruit growing on the island. They stayed there for 6 days, and one night there was such a huge downpour they managed to collect 2 kegs of rainwater by using their sail. From there they island hopped, hoping to find more turtles, but none was to be found. As they rounded Cape York, they began the most perilous leg of their journey. As soon as they were in the Gulf of Carpentaria, they encountered a group of natives that are believed to have been Torres Strait Islanders. Mary and her crew became alarmed when they started canoeing out to them with what they deemed to be aggressive body language. They fired their musket once in response to scare them off, but this only aggravated the situation as the natives retaliated by firing arrows at them. Fortunately, none of the arrows reached their boat. They continued to sail along. They were now desperate for water, so had no choice but to come ashore again. They managed to find a deserted spot and filled up, but didn't want to risk spending the night, so they returned to the safety of their boat. In the morning, they started to return to land again to get more water, but this time they were spotted. James Martin described the scene, quote, "We saw 2 very large canoes coming towards us. We did not know what to do, for we were afraid to meet them. There seemed to be 30 or 40 men in each canoe. They had sails in their canoes, seemed to be made out of matting. One of their canoes was ahead of the others, a little way stopped, until the other came up, and then she hoisted her sails and made after us. As soon as we saw that, we tacked about with what we had, determined to cross the gulf, which was about 500 miles across which, as God would have it, we outrun them. They followed us until we lost sight of them." End quote. They risked one more stop before embarking on the 800-kilometre treacherous journey to Timor. On the 5th of June, they finally spotted land and pulled into a Dutch settlement in Kopang. Their epic journey had taken 69 days, and they had travelled roughly 5,237 kilometres. They staggered into the small settlement, absolutely exhausted and half-starved. William wrote that Mary and the children had borne, quote, "their sufferings with more fortitude than most among them," end quote. Despite their weariness and fatigue, they all had to be alert as the Dutch authorities began questioning them. It was crucial that they remembered their stories. They told the authorities that William Bryant was friends of a whale fisher and the ship had gone down and they were the only survivors. The governor believed their story and fed and clothed them. This was not the first time a boatload of English people had arrived on their shores. The first had been Bligh, who had been cast adrift by Bounty mutineers and travelled the same distance in an open boat. Their incredible journey may well have inspired Mary and her group. They quickly slotted into life in the settlement, even getting jobs, and lived quite happily. But as Watkin Tench described it, quote, "their behaviour giving rise to suspicion, they were watched, and one of them at last, in a moment of intoxication, betrayed the secret," end quote. That person was William Bryant. Martin recorded, quote, "We remained very happy at our work for 2 months till William Bryant had words with his wife, went and informed against himself, wife and children, and all of us. We was immediately taken prisoners and was put in the castle," end quote. Despite repeatedly denying Bryant's drunken slip, they were put into confinement. However, they were still given some freedoms. Martin claimed that they, quote, "were allowed to go out of the castle 2 at a time for 1 day, and the next day 2 more, and so continued," end quote. That was until Captain Edwards arrived in the settlement. Captain Edwards was a British naval officer who arrived in the settlement with a band of mutineers he was delivering back to England. Once he had secured the mutineers safely in the castle, he began his interrogation of Mary and her party. According to a man named Basil Thompson, Edwards, quote, was a cold, hard man devoid of sympathy and imagination, end quote. Eventually, one of them broke and confessed that they were convicts and divulged where they had come from. On October 5th, 1791, they boarded the Rembang. Martin claimed that Edwards, quote, put us in irons called bilboes, end quote. A bilbo was a long iron bar with sliding shackles attached to it, which was fastened to the floor. So for the first time in years, the convicts were shackled around the ankles. They sailed to Batavia, arriving on the 7th of November, having survived a dreadful storm. They arrived in a weary, bedraggled state. Batavia was nothing like the island paradise they had just left. Batavia was known as a disease-infested settlement. The death toll was extremely high for many visiting ships, and those people that were lucky enough to escape with their lives left incredibly ill. Captain Cook described it in December 1770, quote, Batavia is certainly a place that Europeans need not covet to go to, but if necessity obliges them, they will do well to make their stay as short as possible. Otherwise, they will soon feel the effects of the unwholesome air of Batavia, which, I firmly believe, is the death of more Europeans than any other place upon the globe of the same extent. End quote. Sadly, their visit was no different. And on the 1st of December, Mary's little baby boy Emmanuel died, followed by Mary's husband 21 days later. The loss of her beloved husband and 20-month-old baby boy hit her incredibly hard, and she slipped into a depressed state. The fire inside her that had helped get them from Sydney to Timor had left her. To make matters worse, she, along with her daughter Charlotte and William Allen, was separated from the other men that had become like family to her. They were put on a ship called the Horsen, and the other men were taken to the Hornweg. They set sail again, with many still suffering from the unhealthy conditions at Batavia. As they were sailing through the Sunda Strait, James Cox, one of her husband's closest friends, either fell overboard or decided to jump and was never seen again. William Morton also succumbed to the, quote, unwholesome air, end quote, of Batavia. It was another huge blow to Mary. On the 18th of March 1792, they arrived at Table Bay, and 5 days later, Mary, Charlotte, and William Allen were transferred to another ship, the Gorgon, and happily they were reunited when days later the other escapees joined them. It must have been surreal being on the Gorgon, as the ship had come from Australia and was crowded with reminders of their past. Kangaroos, Australian animal skins, plants and shrubs. Plus, there were so many familiar faces, as many Marines that served in the colony were on the ship. Martin remarked, quote, we was well known by all the Marine officers, which was all glad that we had not perished at sea, end quote. Watt Contench wrote, quote, I confess that I never looked at these people without pity and astonishment. They had miscarried in a heroic struggle for liberty. After having combated every hardship and conquered every difficulty, I could not but reflect with admiration at the strange combination of circumstances which had again brought us together to baffle human foresight and confound human speculation. End quote. They sailed for Portsmouth on the 5th or 6th of April. 2 weeks into their journey, the weather became scorching, and the intense heat brought about the death of many of the children of the Marines. A total of 7 children died. Then, on the afternoon of the 6th of May, Charlotte lost her life. A distraught Mary committed her little, lifeless body to the deep, dark sea. Mary now had nothing to live for. She had lost everything. When they arrived in Portsmouth on the 18th of June, Mary was deep in her grief. She was returning to the shores of England after 5 years with nothing and still a prisoner. Her and her travel companions were thrown into Newgate Prison to await their fate. Newgate was an unimaginably putrid prison. Jail fever was rife in the overcrowded confined spaces. A newspaper reported that the magistrate who committed them to Newgate had said, quote, "He never experienced so disagreeable a task as being obliged to commit them to prison, and assured them that, as far as lay in his power, he would assist them," end quote. However, despite the clemency of the Crown, the court was quite severe and sentenced them, quote, "to remain on their former sentences until they should be discharged by due course of law," end quote. The newspapers couldn't get enough of Mary's story and her plight and frequently wrote about her, drumming up huge sympathy from their readers. The Dublin Chronicle wrote on the 21st of July, 1792, quote, "This escape was perhaps the most hazardous and wonderful effort ever made by 9 persons, for 2 were infants, to regain their liberty," end quote. One such reader, James Boswell, a lawyer who was known for successfully fighting for seemingly lost causes, decided to fight on Mary's behalf. He appealed to the Home Office for clemency and used his connections and eventually secured a pardon for Mary. It was granted on the 2nd of May, 1793, 6 weeks after her original sentence had expired. Mary was now a free woman. She could scarcely believe it. But surprisingly, she did not rush back to Cornwall to be with her family. Despite her release, she was severely depressed. Her freedom must have felt bittersweet, with no William, Charlotte, or Emmanuel to enjoy it with. She ended up staying in London until October, until James finally convinced her to return home. He had written to her sisters, who had assured him that Mary would be welcomed back with open arms. He not only paid for her passage home, but promised her he would send her a monthly allowance, quote, "as long as she behaved well," end quote. He also wanted to hear how she was doing. As she could not write, they agreed that she would get others to write on her behalf and she would sign it with her initials. This agreement was honoured. James continued to fight for the freedom of Mary's companions. Now only 4 of them remained. He couldn't have been more dedicated, so much so that one night, when he was returning home, he was accosted, robbed, and left unconscious. The violent assault left him bedridden, but even from his bed and only 9 days after the attack, he wrote again on their behalf and managed to secure their freedom. In November that year, they too were released. Mary and her friends had no way of ever repaying James for all that he had done for them. All they had between them were a few wild sarsaparilla tea leaves they had picked in the colony and brought with them on their extraordinary journey. James accepted the heartfelt gift and treasured it. He never used them, but kept them as a memento, and 2 of those precious leaves are now sitting in the Mitchell Library in New South Wales, having made their way back to their homeland. I hope you've enjoyed the story. There is ongoing speculation about who was the driving force behind the escape. Some say it was William and some say Mary. I personally think everyone on that boat took an incredible amount of risk, and therefore everyone on board must have been 100% committed to going. All of them were incredibly brave, particularly Mary, who was the only woman and had two young children in her care. And James Boswell, what a man! It's such an emotional story. All the escapees went on to lead very quiet lives. John Butcher, believe it or not, returned to New South Wales by enlisting in the New South Wales Corps. As a private, he was granted land on the 5th of September, 1795. And as for Mary, she disappears into obscurity. It is thought that eventually she remarried, which may be why she has not been able to be traced. Not even the date of her death is known. I like to think that she went on to lead a quiet, peaceful, happy life. If you've loved this tale, I highly recommend getting yourself a copy of the mini-series that was released in 2004 called The Incredible Journey of Mary Bryant. The story has been dramatised, but it is a great film. Thanks for listening. Thank you for listening to the Convict Australia podcast. If you'd like to show your appreciation and get more involved, there are a number of ways you can. The first is by signing up to Convict Australia on Patreon, and you will get some perks like the Convict Australia newsletter. Secondly, leave a review and tell your friends and family. This really does make a huge difference. And lastly, join the Facebook and Instagram group Convict Australia. All the links I've mentioned will be in the show notes. Thank you again. Till next time.